Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoof.
It's Wednesday, April 24th from HPR2. It's The Conversation. Misconduct conducts bad cops to the door.
Sowing sustainable seeds of hope.
Clear care for the obviously ill.
And hele on to Ciclovia.
Deutsche Welle has today's international news. We've got a backyard ghost of the sweet long ago and distracted public servants in the reality check. Here's the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
Shower the people you love with love.
Dulcet tones of James Taylor singing Shower the People at the memorial service this afternoon for a fallen MIT police officer. 27-year-old Sean Collier was killed last week, allegedly by the Boston bombing suspects. Today, thousands of law enforcement officials from across the nation join MIT students and faculty. Vice President Joe Biden told the vast crowd, terrorists will never win.
We are grieving, but we are not bending. We will not yield to fear. We will not hunker down. We will not be intimidated.
Meanwhile, U.S. investigators are in southern Russia questioning the parents of the Boston Marathon bombing suspects, Jahar and Tarmalin Tsarnaev. Jahar, the younger of the two, is recovering at an area hospital from wounds sustained during a gun battle with police last week. His brother was killed. The New York Police Department is teaming up with Brookhaven National Laboratory to study how chemical and biological weapons could be dispersed through the air into the city's subway system. NPR's Margot Adler reports that the test will take place on 3 days this summer.
Brookhaven National Laboratory is a leader in studying tracer gases and airflow. Researchers will track harmless gases which can mimic how a chemical or biological weapon would react if released. Low concentrations of the gases will be released in all five boroughs, and there will be some 200 sampling devices. The project is funded under a $3.4 million federal grant. NYPD Commissioner Ray Kelly says the field study will help safeguard the city's population in the event of an actual attack. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
Massive thunderstorms are moving across New Orleans and surrounding areas, which prompted a tornado warning a short time ago. Wind gusts of up to 60 miles an hour have been reported at the airport. Eileen Fleming of member station WWNO took shelter at her house.
I can hear the wind rattling my windows. I have about six of them along the side of my house, and they are rattling. I'm hoping they're going to just continue to keep the rain out and nothing will blow into them, because no one's had any time to actually go out into their backyards and get the potted plants out, put the furniture down. I just basically got a few minutes notice, walked around the house, tried to pick things up, and then came in the closet. So I'm just hoping that my neighbor's property doesn't come crashing through my windows.
That's Eileen Fleming, reporter for member station WWNO. A short time ago, she told us that coastal communities are now being affected. At last check on Wall Street, Dow is down 19 points at 14,700. You're listening to NPR News. The threat of more floods is growing in parts of the Midwest, where rivers are still rising following more rain. Vicki Turner is director of Peoria County Emergency Management in Illinois. She says shelters have been set up to help people forced from their homes by flooding along the Illinois River.
Red Cross has set up shelters for us, and we've been having food and water and that for the people.
The National Weather Service says it expects water levels to remain high in some areas through May. Senate lawmakers are taking up online privacy today. NPR's Jill Snyder reports Democrats are pushing for a clear way for consumers to opt out of being tracked online by advertisers.
West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, has been working for more privacy protections, but he backed off his efforts a couple of years ago after the tech industry said it would work with consumer groups to voluntarily drop ways for Internet users to opt out of having information collected about their web activities. The Commerce Committee is to get an update on that effort, and the industry says it has made progress, pointing to a self-regulatory program managed by the Digital Advertising Alliance. But Rockefeller has reintroduced his proposal to subject companies to penalties by the Federal Trade Commission if they violate a consumer's Do Not Track request. Jael Snyder, NPR News, Washington.
A Senate confirmation vote on President Obama's nominee for Labor Secretary is postponed until May 8th. Democrat Tom Harkin, who chairs the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, says he's worried that Republicans will use a separate hearing to criticize nominee Thomas Perez's handling of a whistleblower case. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at Wix.com.
This is The Conversation on HPR 2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Clean, transparent, accountable. Somehow, despite TV dramas and the real-life lack of comprehensive information about police officers, some people still want a police force that is, well, clean, transparent, and publicly accountable. That would include Daryl Perry, the Kauai Chief of Police and 30-year Honolulu Police Department veteran, is outspoken about the police department he'd like to have. It's one that has a special division for finding cops behaving badly and getting them off the force. Chief Perry is on the phone with us from his office in Lihue. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you for having me on.
And thank you for being willing to talk to us. Now, we talk about bad cops, and that cuts a pretty wide swath. But how do you really grade misconduct? Be real specific about what is your definition of serious misconduct.
Well, we have in place what we worked out with the SHOPO, which is the Union for Police Officers, an agreement. And the document that we use is what we determined as or labeled as a standard of conduct. And within this document, there are actually 64 standards that the officers are compelled to abide by. And this is not only while they're on duty, but while they're off duty 24/7.
But
43 of those articles can lead to dismissal. So we have a standard practice in place that holds our officers accountable.
But we know, just from what we know we don't see in the public sphere and the lack of records available, and even some of the summaries that lawmakers are supposed to be getting and reviewing, that this is really not making its way into our minds and our ability to judge the police forces across Hawaii. But certainly it's something that you know, because you're there just like every other police department. So what has to happen now that we would be able to know about the police misconduct and have it be open and transparent in the way that you would like to have it be, with a special division devoted just to that? Is that really realistic?
It can be realistic, but it has to be within the framework of not only protecting the civil liberties of our officers, while at the same time being transparent and make sure that the public knows what kind of department are serving them. So it's a really double-edged sword, because in some instances, when the cases or the disciplinary action is still going through the arbitration process, and at times it takes maybe months and maybe even years to get that done, and we have to wait until the final disposition comes out. But like you and like others out there, because I'm also a citizen too, I'd want to know whether my department is clean or not. But I can tell you right now that the chiefs of the four counties, including myself, are on board with making sure that our officers do the right things and are being held accountable. Now, getting that information out, as I said, is a double-edged sword, and we want to make sure that our officers are not punished for things that they did not commit. And so it's very a very difficult task to find out where is the balance with that.
Because
what is problematic, though, is that when we do have officers that complaints have been sustained, they have been terminated, then you have the arbitration process, or you have outside influences that bring them back into the ranks where they shouldn't be. And
well,
that becomes problematic for the chief.
And that's your problem exactly right now, is it not? I mean, there have been officers that you would like to see off your force who have come back, and that situation doesn't look like it's necessarily going to change with future problems. But how do you say that other chiefs are on board, and yes, officers are do their due diligence, but shouldn't there be a weight? I mean, where does that weight fall for you in terms of public right to know who potentially on a force is not necessarily the kind of officer that all of us would like to have on a police force? Or do we weight it with the officer going through due process?
Well, the weighting of whether or not the information should be put out in public, I can't speak for the other chiefs, but in terms of serious violations such as committing a criminal act, that information, in my opinion, should be exposed. I mean, should be given out to the public.
Well, especially when you have someone who has repeated violations. I mean, a history, not just this is the first time that something has happened, and maybe you wait a little bit because you need to go through due process and really find out, as you say, whether this person has been wrongly accused or is truly involved. But if somebody has a history and you know that, shouldn't we be able to know that too?
If it's determined that the complaint has been sustained and the person has been terminated, then I believe, but that's not for me to say. It's for the politicians to work it into our statutes. But as it stands right now, that information cannot be released. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about, and this is an area that hasn't been addressed, and how my question was to when I spoke to a civil beat, Nick Gruby, is how is it that we have an officer that comes in from the very onset and whose integrity issues, they have no integrity issues. He goes through the psych eval, the polygraph. We check his personal background, great shape, him or her. And then after a few years, they turn into individuals that commit acts of misconduct. How does that process happen? Where is the failure? Is it with leadership, or is it inherent in the job that we do, or is it the person's responsibility?
So how are you finding that out?
Well, what we're doing right now is we're evaluating how are we going to address that, because what we're seeing from these officers that have acts of misconduct are symptoms of a greater issue. In our recruitment efforts, the number one thing that we look for is integrity. And it's also in our mission statement, respect, integrity, and professionalism. So we have to really analyze what in this job does to these individuals to have them change, because it's not normal for people to come in with high expectations, high integrity, and at the end or middle of their career, they turn into individuals that has acts of misconduct. So it's a very complex issue. So we're trying to address that right now.
On one hand, you're talking about the psychological aspects of what it means to be a police officer. On the other hand, as long as things are happening, making them transparent to the public so we know much more about our police force and those people who are supposed to be protecting us. Can you do both of those at once? Couldn't that be happening at the same time?
Yes, it could. Yes, it could. And that's what we're trying to do. It's a dilemma that has faced law enforcement for the last 100+ years. But the big difference today is that we're holding our people accountable. We're being transparent as best that we can, and yet we have the other side. We want to make sure that the officers that do a good job, which is 99% in my opinion of the officers that do a good job, are not being targeted or not being generalized as being bad officers. And you know, in the recent book that they had before I came here, KPD Blues, that's a book that really, really hurt the department, because some members in the community doesn't want KPD mm-hmm. to move on. We have changed tremendously. But oftentimes, they refer back to that book, and that has nothing to do with the organization today.
Yeah, people keep remembering that. Meantime, you are somewhat at odds with your community in trying to move the police department into the place that we've just been talking about, where there is transparency, there is due diligence, and there is a real focus on why it happens that police officers seem, some anyway, seem to go bad mid-career. Big answers. Meanwhile, though, you've got to run a police department and be publicly accountable. Do you feel that you're doing a better job than anybody else?
No, I'm just doing my job, and that's what I've been paid for. But
I mean, that Kauai is doing a better job than anybody else. Should Kauai be leading this charge?
Well, we're trying to. And
right.
I just want to say that the community members have been very supportive. I mean, the majority of the community out there is very supportive. But there's just a few that whenever something happens or there's some issues, they bring up the past. And that's done. We're moving forward. In fact, we're moving towards accreditation, and that's a huge step towards best practices in the United States. So.
Well, we wish you all the best with that, and we'll check in with you in the future. Thanks so much for talking to us this morning.
Well, thank you, Beth. And don't forget, today is Administrative Professionals Day. So
okay.
If you have a secretary, be sure to recognize her for the good job that she
does. And we know that you will be doing the very same thing. Thank you. Darryl Perry is the chief of the Kauai Police Department. He previously commanded the Juvenile Division, the Narcotics Vice Division, and the Criminal Investigation Division, all after retiring from the Honolulu Police Department. He was born and raised on Kauai, and you heard what he says he wants, a clean, transparent department.
Bad boys, bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? When you were 8 and you had bad traits, you go to school and learn the golden rule. So why are you acting like a bloody fool if you get
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. Later in the show, the nexus of farming and filmmaking, two suitors for the Senate. And next up, you know what's next up, don't you?
Today we're jumping into the Wayback Machine and dialing up the year 1890 to take a look at Lanai's agricultural history. The island's eastern shore was the home of the Mauna Lea Sugar Company, which planted fields of sugarcane and expanded operations to build a sugar plantation. Population numbers exploded when the company brought over 500 laborers, turning a once sleepy fishing village into an agricultural hub. New housing structures appeared, plus a pier and a railroad to transport goods. All the harvested sugar was shipped to Maui to be processed. Lanai's sugar industry continued successfully until 1900, but that was the year the plague that had originated on Oahu affected this village. And what was worse, the freshwater sources that irrigated the fields had turned brackish, forcing Mauna Lea Sugar Company to shut down in 1901. For today's quiz, can you name the ghost town that was once home to Lanai Sugar? We'll be back with the answer in the second half. You would think that if land were valued anywhere, it would be in Hawaii, where it's a dramatically limited resource. But some people in Hawaii may wonder about that. Those who value agriculture and hope to move the least sustainable of states towards sustainability see much to make them hopeful, but they're also dealing with a troubling fact. The average age of today's Hawaii farmer is around 60, and if ag is really a dying profession, where are the seeds of hope? That's the name of a new documentary by farmer-turned-filmmaker Danny Miller, and he's on the phone from his Big Island farm to tell us more. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
It's good to have you. Are you optimistic about the future of ag in Hawaii?
I am, and this project, this film project, is really the primary reason. I was honored to be able to talk to farmers all over the state, and there are so many wonderful and great people doing really incredible work to bring about more local food production in a very sustainable way.
Well, there's no doubt about that.
There's a whole movement right now in this direction that I'm really excited about, and I think the film's part of that movement to really bring about awareness that we need to stop importing 80% of our food to this island.
Danny, there's no doubt that there's that movement, and there's our people, as you describe, but are there enough of them? That's my question.
Well, there is, a growing interest in this, and I think it's going to continue to grow. I think the legislature is beginning to understand the outcry from the public to make changes in our land use laws and to really make a shift away from the old way of importing all of our food to growing more food locally. There probably will never be we'll always be adding people. I think the amount of people that are already involved in the movement is quite significant.
Danny, what kind of law changes in the land use laws do you want to see?
Well, we have laws on the books now that protect ag land, but they continue to overturn those laws or go around those laws. When issues come up, when they want to build a new development, they always find a way to build the development on ag land.
Yeah, and so why are you encouraged is my question, I guess.
Well, I'm encouraged because of the amount of interest by the public.
Okay.
We've had an incredible outcry or interest about the film and people from all over the state and also on the mainland. So the interest is there and the concern is there by the public. And I think we're on a curve to make this big shift. I really do.
Are the public and the legislature on the same wavelength here?
I think it's beginning to be. I really do. I am hopeful. I think we have a lot of work to do with the legislature to make that shift. But I think they are beginning to see that our economy can be stronger, our health can be better, and so many things can be improved if we're creating our own food resources here. The price of food is going up and up and up because it's shipped in. It's not as healthy as local food. And I think all the state leaders are seeing that now, and I think the curve is happening. So I'm very optimistic. We interviewed over 50 farmers and educators in Hawaiian Kupuna across the state, and their stories are amazing, and the amount of work they're doing and the progress they're making is extraordinary. So I'm very hopeful.
Well, I have to wonder, is this a legislative change or a social change that's coming?
Because it's got to be both. I mean, we have to do it socially, but we also have to do it on the government level. I mean, that's where it's going to, that's where the laws have to be shifted in favor of local food production and incentives need to be made. But in the end, it will come from society. It will be coming from individuals. And one of the things we really wanted to do with the film was to inspire individuals that they can make a difference. You can start your own backyard garden in your backyard, on your windowsill. Very simple. And the joy and the pleasure of gardening and farming, even if it's a small little garden in your yard, is extraordinary. And I think people are discovering that. So it can happen on an individual level. It can happen on a community level. There's amazing school garden networks happening now where kids of all ages are growing food at school and learning, wow, this is where food comes from. So it's really a lot of exciting things happening across the state.
Well, there's also this sort of rooftop gardening movement for people in cities. Is that a pretty viable way to grow some vegetables?
I think it is. If you're in an urban environment and you don't have a lot of land, the rooftops are great. And I've seen that with folks in Honolulu, where they have aquaculture on their porch and they're feeding their fish and feeding the plants, and it's possible anywhere, really.
With the people that you talked to in your movie, Danny, was there a lot of awareness of the whole, we're coming out of a tradition of the Hawaiian people that is exactly what we're striving for now, the whole idea of sustainability, the ahupua'a, that kind of
exactly.
thing. Are people aware of this whole you know, everything old is new again idea?
I think that's really coming back. I mean, the revival and the resurgence of the Hawaiian culture and the wisdom that can be found there, that is where the answers are. I mean, they had a sustainable culture here for many hundreds of years, and they were sustainable. They didn't have any imports. And we have now turned that into shipping 80% of our food here. So the wisdom and the knowledge of the Hawaiian people and their culture of how to grow food sustainably, how to work with the Aina and be in harmony with the Aina and not be working against it. So it's a real value and a real incredibly fortunate thing that we're in a place where there is a culture that has these answers.
Given that, Danny, how long do you think it'll take to get from 80% to, say, 70%? 10 years?
I think that can happen soon. I think it can happen in the next decade. I think that's real possible. The film was produced by the Hawaii Rural Development Council, and which is a statewide organization that is made up of individuals that represent different organizations and communities across the state. And our goal and their goal in producing the film was to really inspire people that we can make a change, we can make a difference in our communities, as individuals. So what we wanted to do was to go out and find those inspiring stories.
It sounds as if you did, Danny, and we have to go. But
okay.
Thanks.
Well, thank you so much. Mahalo.
You bet. Danny Miller is a Hawaii Island farmer and the director of Seeds of Hope. The film will be shown tonight and Thursday at the Honolulu Museum of Art, with a panel discussion tonight at 7:30 at the Doris Duke Theater. Details are on the HPR website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travasa.com/Hana.
The president mourns victims in West Texas. In Washington, both sides look for lessons after the gun bill goes down in Congress. Montana Democrat Max Baucus announces his retirement, and the Boston bombing reverberates through the immigration debate. I'm Jennifer Ludden. It's Political Junkie Day. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
This program is brought to you with pride by Hawaii Public Radio's members, volunteers, and community partners. Special thanks to Lehua Lani Coffee Farms, Waymas Cookies, and Madeline McKay for their generous support of Challenge 2013. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We're coming up to 8:29 on The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Brian Schatz was appointed rather than elected to the U.S. Senate. Even so, some say that he's slightly favored to win the 2014 primary contest against U.S. Representative Colleen Hanabusa. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us now for today's reality check. Hi, Chad.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, we have some well-respected national political analysts who say, yeah, he's got an edge. But, I mean, we should say at the outset, she hasn't formally declared her candidacy. She's just sort of made it known that that would be her preferential race.
Correct. Having said that, she hasn't denied it either. But, yes, I expect we can have a formal announcement shortly. She'll actually be back in the islands next week because it's part of Constituent Week. So maybe she'll be sitting down the reporters. But I think it's a done deal. Now, why would Brian Schatz have the edge over Colleen Hanabusa? Well, a couple of things. He is the incumbent. He will have seniority. He already does. He even has seniority over Mazie Hirono, and that matters in the Senate. He's young. He's only 40 years old, so he could make an argument that he could serve for a long time. And then finally, he really did raise a lot of money in the first quarter, over $1 million, and that certainly sends a signal to tell folks he's serious about election to the Senate.
And you can add all into that, too, the fact that D.C. Democrats like him and seem to prefer him in a way. All that said, the flip side of it is that late Senator Inouye would have preferred Colleen Hanabusa. The question is, how much weight will that really hold now, or is it a matter of, reaching out from beyond the grave and a nice wish, but not necessarily something that's going to carry a lot of weight?
National experts say both things. Yes, you'll absolutely hear Dan Inouye's name mentioned over and over again in campaign ads. Others say, no, he's gone from the scene. You can't really run on somebody else's legacy. Colleen Hanabusa has strengths of her own, though. She definitely has more experience in Congress. She held leadership positions in the state Senate. Being Japanese-American fits well with the state's demographic. And remember this, females vote in higher numbers than males in the primary, particularly in primaries. So that could help her. I can tell you that the analysts say it'll probably be a close race and could go either way, even though Schatz has the edge.
Well, bottom line of it, we got a horse race.
You know, I can tell you this, talking to one of the experts, he's very well known, Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia.
And
he said, you know, usually your federal races are pretty boring in Hawaii. They really are never very close.
And it's very rare.
He said that has now changed. You can cross boring off of your list. The Schatz Hanabusa race will definitely be an exciting one, and that excites me, as you know, political junkie that I am.
Well, I join you in that, and that's why it's going to be a good thing this time around. It's always a good thing when people get out and vote and exercise their ability to do so. But in this case, knowing that really we are fundamentally in a different position now than we've ever been, and this is going to be some campaign. Glad you'll be there too.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. I've got Bert on the line to find out what a digital native is.
Well, a digital native is one of those young folks, which, you know, I'll exclude myself from that category, that get born into the Internet age and are pretty much fully versed at, using the Internet, using the web, even perhaps getting born with a smartphone in their hand.
Never knew a world without it, right?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, when that is becoming more and more common, the question becomes, what is it that they have to do to be responsible citizens online? And, you know, of course, I think school has a certain amount of responsibility, you know, and parents to teach kids, you know, the being responsible in real life, you know, in society and how they interact with their fellow peers. So how does that translate to life online? Because more and more, these digital natives are spending a lot of time online, and they are projecting their persona online. So what is it to become a digital citizen?
And, what's going to happen to them looking at the entire world on a 3x5 screen, Bert? That's a concern, I would think.
Well, not only a 3x5 screen, but, you know, what can you put onto that screen? There's everything from videos to audio to images to, you know, text.
Yeah.
You can tell a lot about a person. You know, right now there's that whole fad going on, taking spoonfuls of cinnamon. I mean, that's crazy. But
that's
again,
one of the things we have the Internet to thank. We've got to run.
So what do you want to be when you put your persona online?
Well, go easy on the cinnamon, Bert.
Okay.
And that's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
A It's The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Coming up, the importance of the right label, a postcard from Cyclovia, and now the global report from Deutsche Welle.
DW Deutsche Welle News.
This is Jane McIntosh in Bonn. At a meeting of NATO yesterday, members were urged to draw up contingency plans in the event of chemical weapons being used in Syria. The move comes as Israeli military intelligence claimed forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had used chemical weapons. The US government declined to give a verdict, saying it is still studying evidence. Last week, UN diplomats said Britain and France had provided what they thought was strong evidence that chemical weapons had been used. Speaking after the meeting in Brussels on Tuesday, NATO Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said the alliance was extremely concerned about the use of ballistic missiles in Syria and the possible use of chemical weapons.
There is no call for NATO to play a role, but if these challenges remain unaddressed, they could directly affect our own security. So we will continue to remain extremely vigilant.
Following Tuesday's car bomb attack on the French embassy in Libya, President François Hollande has called on the Libyan authorities to shed light on the attack so the perpetrators can be brought to justice. Two guards were injured in the attack early Tuesday. Libya's Foreign Minister Mohamed Abdel Aziz declined to comment on who may have carried out the attack or possible motives. The bombing was the first attack on a foreign mission in Libya since the US consulate in Benghazi was attacked last September. In Canada, the two men accused of plotting to derail passenger trains have appeared in court. 30-year-old Chiheb Essegaya appeared in a court in Montreal. He spoke in French and called the allegations unfair. He declined to be represented by a court-appointed lawyer. His co-accused, 35-year-old Yaid Yaza, appeared in court in Toronto. He did not enter a plea and was given a new court date for the end of May. The French Parliament has given its final approval to same-sex marriage and allowing gay couples to adopt children. The socialist-majority National Assembly voted 331 to 225 to adopt the bill. The new laws are expected to come into force in June. After the vote, campaigners were celebrating.
We are not taking anything away from anybody. I don't see why people think they can tell me how I should live my life. That isn't right, so I'm really happy right now.
However, there's been opposition to the new law, and shortly after the vote, lawmakers from right-wing parties announced a constitutional challenge. The council will have a month to make a ruling. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.de. This is Jane McIntosh, Deutsche Welle News.
You probably bristle when someone introduces you incorrectly. The wrong words, the wrong impression. No one likes to be classified by a label. And yet, we pigeonhole people all the time, often just to define them for ourselves. A bill back in conference today is also concerned with screening out the wrong words, in this case to describe the chronically mentally ill and help from assisted community treatment, once termed outpatient services. In changing some of those words, some opponents to the bill changed their minds, much to the pleasure of Institute for Human Services Executive Director Connie Mitchell, who joins us now. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Beth Ann.
We've talked about this bill for a while now, since practically it was introduced, with the idea of how do we really segregate those who most need help and don't really know it? How do we help them without trampling on their civil rights, even if they don't realize they have civil rights? And that's what this bill is seeking to do.
That's correct.
Yet it's gone through a couple of permutations and the language changes to really make it very clear and put out seven lines of criteria that have to be followed for this to be applicable. So we're really talking about a very small amount of people here, aren't we?
That's correct. We're really looking at those people that impact our care systems the most. People who are picked up by the police a lot, that are taken to the emergency rooms, people who go to jail a lot for very small crimes because of their mental illness. So it's really not about, you know, every person who's mentally ill, not at all. It's really about those people who tend to get into trouble or really need a lot of extra help because they're not accepting treatment. They're not really realizing that they're even ill in a lot of times.
And this is clearly not a means to sweeping the homeless off the streets.
Absolutely
either.
Not. I think people have a great many fears, and there's been just so much attention on the homeless. But I think for us, we have an urban outreach team that goes and talks to a lot of homeless people. I know that many of those people are not going to be affected by this bill, but there are some people who are just so mentally ill, very fixed delusions, just really are not accepting of treatment. And currently, if you don't accept treatment, there's not a whole lot that you can do. We did have a bill, or a law, I should say, on outpatient, involuntary outpatient treatment, but it wasn't working very well. I think it was only used once successfully in the last 13 years. So we really felt like we needed to have something more effective. And I really believe that we've come up with a bill that will do the trick.
So this one seems to tighten it down a
yes.
little bit more so that someone who is a family member or someone who knows the person who is non-compos could pave the way for that person to be accepting of treatment potentially, or at least acknowledge the fact to someone else in the system that this person really needs treatment and doesn't need to be shuttling back and forth between jail cells.
That's correct. And it requires more than just someone deciding that, you know, they want to petition for it. It really requires a psychiatrist to determine that this person, in fact, has been diagnosed with a mental illness and really maybe not able to care for themselves or not able to make those decisions because of their mental illness that would help them stay healthy. So they're really in danger of not being well or injuring themselves. So it's really something that brings treatment to people instead of feeling like you're taking away rights of the person.
And again, all of the criteria have to be met, not
exactly.
just one or five of them, but
right.
all seven.
Exactly. And the psychiatrist has to go in with a treatment plan, you know, a treatment plan, a service plan that would help people or help the judge at court understand what would be in store for the person. A designated mental health provider would have to be named so that when a person was not doing well, that mental health provider would be responsible for basically seeking out the person and trying to engage them so that they would take their medication.
This is based on a New York law, the Kendra's Law, isn't
That's
it?
That's correct.
But for us, because our population is so much smaller, really, how many people are we talking about when we say a small number? Are we talking under 100, under 50?
I think, you know, it depends which people are going to fall under, you know, those all those criteria. But I know that looking at the people who go to jail, there might be about 20 people that have more than 10 arrests in 2 years, say, and who are mentally ill. And even those people, we're not sure if they would fit all the seven criteria. So those are one segment that we might be able to use this law with. But there's also a number of people that are repeatedly brought to the emergency room on a mental health evaluation, emergency mental health evaluation. And I think those people, I'm thinking maybe about 80 people, maybe. And again, you know, we'd have to have all the pieces in place, like having a designated mental health provider who would be willing to be the person responsible for providing the treatment. So we're not talking about a flood of people into the courts all at one time.
No, you're talking about a very strategic, targeted, measured approach to be able to help those who seem to be at the very bottom of,
yes.
of the barrel
right.
of those who wind up on the streets because they can't help themselves. This group really doesn't even know that perhaps it even needs help.
Right. And I also want to emphasize that it isn't only just for homeless people, because there are people who are severely mentally ill and they're basically being cared for by their families.
They're sitting in somebody's living room.
Exactly. And I think the families go through so much, you know, not being able to help their loved ones. And we're hoping that this also will be able to help some of those folks.
At this point in time, it doesn't seem to be that there are many opponents to this bill. Certainly there haven't been opponents among lawmakers, but
right.
it was more the Department of Health and Dr. Lord Arfuddy. But when you changed the language, their attitude changed too.
Well, I think they were they appreciated the intent of the law in terms of bringing more mental health services to people who needed it. But I think the sticking point at the very end, I think, was just our execution date, you know, when it would actually go into effect, because they realized that the system needs to change and the system needs to be ready to implement this particular piece of legislation. So we've been really working hard to find a compromise, and I think we achieved that last night.
And also with a word about mandated, because someone cannot be mandated to take medication.
Right, but the law does have the judge deciding that the person needs to take it. The issue was whether someone would be physically forced to take medications, and that is not part of this law.
We don't have very long to wait and find out what happened. It was carryover from yesterday. We'll see if it wraps up today. Connie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Bethan.
Connie Mitchell heads the state's largest social services agency, the Institute for Human Services. IHS provides help for chronically or potentially homeless people, including those with physical and mental disabilities, and former inmates and families at risk of becoming homeless. The bill to create assisted community treatment for obviously mentally ill people, as defined by very specific criteria, will be back in conference this afternoon, and the link to it is on our website.
Hi, good morning. I'm Joanne Chang from Boston's Flower Bakery and Myers & Chang. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Earlier today, we asked you if you remember the agricultural history of Lanai. Over a century ago, the eastern coastline was a bustling hub of industry with a thriving sugar plantation and a newly constructed pier and railroad. The local population jumped from fewer than 200 to 900 people, including 500 mostly Japanese workers imported to work the fields for the Manulei Sugar Company. The plague of 1900 changed all that. From Honolulu, the disease hit Lanai sugar plantation hard. To make matters worse, the fresh water brought to irrigate the fields turned brackish. Some people still say the company brought on its ill fortune. According to the story, the construction of the railroad displaced the sacred stones of a heiau. Today, not much remains of the abandoned plantation, but if you visit, you can still catch sight of a small train and track, the renovated Malama Lama Church, and, at low tide, two of Lanai's ancient Hawaiian fish ponds, and perhaps a vision of what once was the successful sugar town of Keomuku. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you're a regular bicyclist in the city of Honolulu and you're not a nervous wreck by now, congratulations. Chances are you've found a way to accommodate the fact that it's not the most bike-friendly city. To you, the idea of a safe and leisurely cruise through locked-off streets is an especially welcome one, and a ciclovia is an ideal way to spend a day. Cycle On Hawaii is planning a ciclovia event for Kaka'ako in May called Hele On Kaka'ako, and now is a good time to start planning for it. Natalie Iwasa is on hand to tell us more. And Natalie, we should probably define ciclovia before we go too much further.
Thank you, Chris. Yes, ciclovia is from the Latin term meaning bike paths, and actually it's kind of expanded to include closed streets for bicyclists, pedestrians, and anything on two wheels, basically.
Started in Colombia?
Yes, Bogota, Colombia. And it's really neat because every week they close about 75 miles of roadway for bicyclists and pedestrians, and they have over 1 million participants.
That's so people are ready and waiting to jump on this opportunity when provided, yeah?
Yes, they are.
Would the people of Honolulu be, you know, if you were really to just convert the streets en masse like that, would the bicyclists in this city be ready to jump on that?
You know, I think so. We've had a lot of different surveys and votes on different issues related to bicycling, and they all have wide support for increasing bicycling.
We were talking a little while ago before the show about the whole thing in European cities where it's just part of the culture for somebody in a business suit to bicycle to work. And you were telling me about the stats for Copenhagen, which amazed me.
Yes, that's really one of my visions is getting a place like Copenhagen. What they have is about 50% bicycle commuting rate within the city, and then from the suburbs, it's about 35%. So that wasn't good enough for them. And what they decided to do was install bike highways. One came online, I believe it was last year, and they have another one that's either coming online or maybe was last the end of last year. And they want to increase the suburb to town bike commuting rate up to 50% as well.
Are they actually building roadways specifically for bicycles then?
Yes, that's my understanding.
They're not even converting existing ones. They're going right at this.
I believe it's a brand new roadway just for bicyclists.
And just for purposes of comparison, our rate, where it's 50% in Copenhagen, it's, you said, a little more than 1% in Honolulu?
Yeah, I've seen anywhere from like 1.5 to a little more than 1.5.
How do you manage not to be discouraged by that, Natalie?
You know, we talked about that. I feel like there are opportunities for improvement in Honolulu, certainly. And if I didn't have hope, I wouldn't continue, but I believe that we can make things better for bicyclists and make some headway here.
What are the steps? I mean, you can have an event like this and increase the appreciation. I mean, the people who take part are certainly going to appreciate the opportunity. And what's that going to lead to?
Well, there's a lot of education that happens at an event like this. And there are many facets involved with improving the facilities for bicyclists and the environment for them as well. So it's not just about closing the streets for one day. It's about educating on a continual basis. It's about going down to our state legislature and educating our legislators, city council, making changes in our laws, doing things like we are doing today, educating the media and getting the word out to the public. And these are all different ways that we can make improvements.
How are the safety statistics for riding a bicycle in this city? Are they pretty bad?
You know, actually, I try not to look at that because I feel that the public already has the perception that it's unsafe.
No need to scare them further.
Exactly. So I try to attack it from the perspective of educating people and mm-hmm. trying to encourage them to get out. We also do things like bike to school days and bike parades, workshops, those types of things.
Workshops in what?
Well, another thing that we're involved with is safe routes to school.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also making improvements within two-mile radiuses of the schools, putting in things like sidewalks, maybe some additional signage, you know, those types of things.
So safe route to school would mean just sort of maybe a kid would sort of walk or drive the route with his parents and maybe say, I could cut across here or, avoid this intersection, that kind of thing?
Right. They take a look at the different routes that are available to the students in the area and then pick one or, you know, the best ones that are around and, if necessary, make improvements to them. You know, a lot of our schools don't even have sidewalks on them around them. So it's taking a look at what's there, making improvements, and then using those routes.
Are there certain types of busy intersections that you can identify that you know, pose particular problems that are kind of that you would sort of red flag as places to avoid?
For a bicyclist?
Yeah.
You know, I think bicyclists always just need to be aware of their surroundings. Bicyclists are allowed to use take the lane. Mm-hmm. And so in some cases, I think a situation can be improved by doing that. And so, again, it comes down to perception. And so one of the things we do is offer adult education classes for bicyclists and for motorists.
When you say take the lane, Natalie, you mean occupy a lane of traffic just the same way a car does, just be right in the middle between the lines, and is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you're entitled to that, and although perhaps some drivers might not agree.
That's true, and that's another area where education is really important. But it's important to understand that bicyclists may take the lane for various reasons. It's not just when it's narrow. There may be debris on the side of the road. There's various reasons that a bicyclist might want to take the lane.
And they have a legal entitlement to do just that.
Exactly.
Natalie, thanks very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Natalie Iwasa is the president of Cycle On Hawaii, which is putting on its Hele On Kaka'ako event on Mother's Day, May 12th. And details can be gleaned from our HPR website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from St. Andrew's Priory School for Girls, offering a K-12 college preparatory curriculum in downtown Honolulu, announcing an open house this Sunday at 1 p.m. Priory.net.
The Atherton 2013 concert season begins Saturday, May 4th at 7:30 as Michael Tannenbaum and Stephen Fox share an evening of Celtic-infused soundscapes with guest appearances by saxophonist Randy Wheeler, Stephen Inglis guitar, and Robert Wehrman piano. Tannenbaum plays guitar and Fox plays the enigmatic Santur cymbalum, and both have collaborated for over a decade, sharing a cinematic breath and delicate acoustic instrumental sensitivity in their personal compositions. Reservations at 955-8821 during business hours.
We started the hour talking with the chief of police on Kauai about what he's been quite vocal about when it comes to letting us know about the misconduct of police officers. And the real question seems to be, where do you weight what you're going to do? Do you weight it with the public's right to know about what's happening or with the process of due diligence with the police officer? And it's not as clean-cut as it would appear. It really comes down to what's gone before. What do you know of the history? All that said, where do you weigh in on this?
Well, I mean, what's gone before has unfortunately included far too much of a kind of circle-the-wagons culture that police departments nationwide have. And it really takes courage to buck that, but, you really have to take a misconduct-is-misconduct approach. But it's never going to be a popular one in any police department. I thought he's taken a very courageous stand, and the fact that he comes from a place of a great deal of experience as a police officer gives it a lot of credibility.
Both in Honolulu and now back home on Kauai. Still, though, there's going to be a lot of tension because there are things that clearly, if we were to know about them, we'd be able to access that information fairly easily, and we can't. But, hey, we pay their salaries, too. We should know who's behaving like a bad cop and who doesn't.
That is the idea, isn't it?
We'll see how far that gets us. Meanwhile, for today, we got to say goodbye. Up tomorrow, we're going to talk about another food policy bill and what's happening with the land to either grow food or perhaps something else.
And a general's granddaughter relives memories of a historic alliance between U.S. and Chinese forces.
You can always talk back to us, your radio, each other. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or me at Because HPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, you can get it on our HPR website. I'm Chris Vandergoed.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.